You're listening to Avacynt on the Record, a podcast discussing key trends and insights into government-driven markets.
Hi, everyone, and welcome to Avacynt on the Record. This is Joe Walsh, I'm principal at Avacynt and head of the London office. I'm joined here by my colleagues, Jay Carmel, senior associate at Avacynt, Matt Karras, principal at Avacynt, Chris Higgins, principal, Logan Sloan, senior associate, and Mike Brandt, associate at the firm. Welcome to the 2019 Paris Air Show preview podcast. We've got a big crew of folks from Avacynt, both from our U.S. office in D.C., as well as from London and Paris, who will be attending the show. We're very excited about the show this year. It's coming at an interesting time for the industry. A lot of change, a lot of uncertainty, both on the commercial aero and on the defense side. We've got a sort of a weakening economic picture, both in Europe and in the U.S., not to mention emerging market weakness, which is really critical to commercial aero growth. And on the commercial aero side, we're beginning to see both a slowdown in orders, the pace of orders, both at Airbus and Boeing, as well as financial trouble among some of the weaker carriers on the low-cost side. In defense, times are still good for now, but there's definitely, I think, a tapering of U.S. defense spending, and we may see European governments tighten belts as well. So both potential weakness or potential challenges on commercial aero and on the defense side. Not to mention, you know, some big developments in recent days on the industry side, both sort of consolidation and mega mergers. We've seen the announcement of potential merger between UTC and Raytheon, which would create the second largest defense contractor behind only Lockheed Martin, and a number of other developments both in Europe and the U.S. So this is the kind of the backdrop that we're headed to Paris with. Everyone will be going to Le Bourget, walking around the airfield alongside the rest of the aerospace industry. And I think to kick it off, we really need to begin with the elephant in the room, which is the story around consolidation, which has defined kind of the trend in the industry in the last months and really last few years. So my first question is going to go to perhaps Chris and then Logan. You know, we woke up this morning to the news that a potential merger is going to take place between UTC and Raytheon, which really continues the trend towards consolidation that we've seen on both sides of the Atlantic. Probably not wise to speculate about whether this deal is going to go forward, but, you know, certainly some interesting implications if it does. Maybe starting with Chris, you know, what do you think about the logic of the combination? Is it going to create value? And, you know, what are some of the questions that you have and that you'll be looking at as we see more details emerge?
Yeah, thanks, Joe. You know, I think if you step back and look at what's going on with consolidation, I think some of the themes you can pull out is, I think defense and commercial aerospace may be coming back together. They were separated in the 80s and 90s, and that's when the commercial aerospace market was a lot smaller. It was probably a third or a fourth of the size it is today. And defense players could largely ignore commercial aerospace, focus on their core defense business. You saw a lot of defense names exit the commercial aerospace business over the years, Lockheed Martin, you saw McDonnell Douglas fail. I think it's a lot harder for defense players now to be pure defense primes. The commercial aerospace side, in terms of manufacturing, in terms of supply chain management, aftermarket services, technologies like auto-autoclave composites, some of the connected aircraft things they're doing. You look at the corporate venturing arms of Airbus and Boeing are very active. You know, you look at all those things, I think the value to be created, a lot of it's going to be some of the commercial aerospace expertise in those areas flowing to Raytheon. And so I think that that's a pretty compelling case for a defense prime like Raytheon. And that's something you saw with Boeing on the TX, for example. That program, Boeing really invested up front on that program on the back of its commercial aerospace cash flow, and it's leveraging that program for its commercial aerospace business. So I think the synergies between defense and commercial aerospace, that's something that I think the industry got away from, but it's coming back now, and I think you might see a lot more companies kind of emulate Boeing's model, and Raytheon United Technologies kind of might be the first opening salvo in this broader trend.
Great. And Logan, what would you say about potential areas of synergy or the logic of the combination?
Yeah, thanks, Joe. I appreciate the opportunity. First of all, I don't think you look at this deal through a traditional value creation lens. Normally, you'd say the logic of a deal comes down to whether or not the business case hunts and the value creation story is there. But in this deal, first of all, there's not a premium, at least as we understand it. And so we're not really looking for the necessity of a significant value creation story. And secondarily, as a lot of folks have said already, there's very little overlap in these companies. So as you look at the plans for integration, obviously they're going to be bringing the six business units that are currently in Collins Aerospace and mashing those together with the Raytheon business units to create sort of four fairly large $18 to $20 billion business units. And so there will be some redundancies there, but not a terrific number. And so we'll talk a little bit more about value creation in a second. But at the headline, I agree with Chris's assessment that there is some benefit to be gained here for a defense company leaning on the commercial side. And I think what we're seeing is a reaction to Boeing. Everybody's watching the wins on TX and MQ-25. Boeing denies it, but most folks in the industry believe Boeing's ability to bid low, particularly on TX, was the result of some corporate portfolio give and take. And so essentially meaning some of the commercial business's profitability was used, if you will, to allow a low margin bid on TX. And as we know, that was ultimately successful. So one of the emerging theses here as we think about it is this approach that is being assumed for how Boeing did that and how Boeing's been successful is replicable, meaning the partnership of a profitable commercial business with a pure play defense supplier will allow for more aggressive bidding if it's needed on the defense side. I'm not sure, thinking about it sort of at the next level, that Raytheon needs the help in the same way Boeing did, not least because so much of Raytheon's work is classified and often sole source, not subject to the same type of competition that Boeing and Lockheed see on these large prime contracts. But certainly the opportunity is there for that hypothesis to play out, and time will tell if this approach really does pay dividends and if the same sort of portfolio shaping will work in the new Raytheon Technologies context. Secondarily, again, at a high level, this seems like it's a bid to diversify the companies and help them work through cycles. And so you have a primarily commercial supplier in Collins Aerospace and Pratt coming together with a primarily defense supplier in Raytheon. And as you think about that combination, we've seen some of the math now come out from the team here, and it's roughly 50-50 commercial and defense. That's an interesting balance because if you think back to some of the times when as an example, Clay Jones was the CEO of Rockwell Collins, there was a concerted effort, and you could see that in a lot of the publications and the industry talking points that we had around trying to maintain that 50-50 defense commercial balance. And it's worked. It worked over the years, certainly in the 2000s, benefited significantly from the defense run-up. And in some respect, that defense run-up, we're thinking here about the Iraq War and the Afghanistan War, all of that defense spending offset a bit of a cycle in this commercial side. And then conversely, as you got closer to the sequestration time, the commercial side was able to support the defense business. Raytheon, I'm not sure, has had as much of an issue as some of the other primes. When I look back at some of their activity and performance through the last budget cycle, 2013 timeframe, they were down about 9% from peak to trough. And Lockheed, as an example, was down about double that. Rockwell Collins was pretty flat. And so you have an argument here that a balanced commercial defense business rides through cycles a little bit better. And so perhaps that's a benefit to this combination as well. I want to turn back quickly to the value creation activity. So we saw the $1 billion number come out of essentially cost synergy activity. Not much on the revenue synergy side, at least nothing quantified, although there are some high-level revenue synergy ideas, I'd say. But the $1 billion really is more like $500 million, and that's a couple analysts are out on the street confirming that. The impact there is the cost plus impact that Raytheon's going to feel from the reduction in cost on some of these activities. So if you think about it as a $500 million synergy number, that's probably close to what we'll see. That number's low for a deal of this size, maybe not for a deal of this size with no implied premium, but it's still low for a deal of this size. In the recent Rockwell Collins UTC deal, we had about four times that amount when you look at it as a percentage of combined revenues. So the $1 billion number, 500 million, is about 2/3%. The Collins deal was closer to 3% of revenues. But again, in this scenario, that value is essentially found money because the share exchange is implying no premium. So value creation is less important. Most of the synergy expectations seem to be coming from supply chain, which is curious because there seems to be so little overlap in what these companies are purchasing. Certainly there would be some overlap in the electronics business, primarily from what to be Rockwell Collins, government systems, circuit boards, things like that. But $375 million in synergies from supply chain is pretty significant. And so that obviously piqued my interest when I looked at the numbers. Some of the other synergy areas, so I'm thinking here the corporate elimination of redundancies. If you think about Raytheon obviously having a fairly significant overhead structure, public company coming together with what was to be UTC Aero, there's a little sleight of hand here maybe because that UTC Aero organization doesn't yet exist. And so I think the folks behind the deal are suggesting that once the deal is complete between Collins and Pratt and the merger and the spinoff then of Carrier and Otis, you'd have a scenario where that UTC Aero would be saddled with a corporate overhead structure. And so there'd be some elimination then between Raytheon and this new UTC Aero. So I think that's how they come up with that number. Again, that structure is not in place today. So there's a little bit of an assumption or a leap of faith there. And then there's a lot of talk about opportunity for technology cooperation and revenue synergies. So here we're taking some of the Raytheon whiz bang stuff and applying it to commercial aero, cyber, autonomy, those sort of things. These are interesting ideas, but the time horizon before we actually see the revenue generated from those is fairly significant, I would anticipate. And the reapplication investment is not small. So what, you know, Raytheon's developing technologies like autonomy and cyber for clearly defense applications, and bringing those into a cockpit and all the certification required with that is not trivial. So things to think about. Obviously, there's a value in combining forces here from a technology perspective, but we do need to recognize that there's a significant time horizon and significant investment involved in making those come to fruition.
Thanks, Logan. So maybe transitioning away from kind of the headline news of the day and going to another segment that has also seen significant consolidation and industry composition shifts in the last several years, the regional market, which I think we're going to be watching very closely at the show. So turning to Mike, we've got both, you know, the Boeing-Embraer combination, the ongoing kind of carve-outs and divestitures from Bombardier's aerospace business, with not just C-Series, but also the many of the regional jet platforms now being sold off. What do you think we can expect from the regional market going forward, both in terms of, you know, new platforms and also, you know, where that segment of the industry is headed?
Yeah, thanks, Joe. So, yeah, I think it's been a really interesting 12 months. I think, you know, in the space of just a year, you've had major tie-ups with two of the real kind of kings of the regional market in Bombardier and Embraer, as you say, and Airbus and Boeing kind of finally taking an interest in that smaller area of the market. And, I mean, that can only be good for growth. You know, having those two heavyweights actually come in and use their influence, use their supply chain, and use their kind of tried and tested aftermarket expertise in that area is only going to create more interest in the market. And I think what's interesting is that so many of these moves have been prompted by Bombardier itself. Not only has Airbus acquired the A220 program, but you have the Q400 recently being bought by Viking Air parent Longview. It'll be really interesting to see what the result of that is and whether Viking Air is actually going to try and make something of that. I think what's going to be interesting to see at the show is just how big a deal does Viking Air make out of the new Dash 8 program that it has now acquired. I think that'll be really telling as to what their strategy is going forward. But also, you know, all of this news around whether Mitsubishi is going to be acquiring the CRJ program, I think that's going to be really interesting as to what Mitsubishi's presence at the Paris Air Show is going to be and whether they're still going to be pushing sales of their existing jets or whether they're really going to be kind of taking a step back, maybe waiting until that transaction goes through, focusing more on the CRJ in the near term and keeping the MRJ to really ramp up production when those CRJs go out of service.
Thanks, Mike. And yeah, I'll personally be watching to see how the marketing and communications is handled, both for, as you say, sort of Mitsubishi and MRJ, given the potential CRJ acquisition, likewise how Boeing and Embraer come forward at the Paris Air Show as their first major air show outing since close, and ultimately kind of how much buzz and attention that market receives.
The other thing I would just add is I think there's also been a lot of excitement around kind of, you know, what is next at the smaller end of the market. I mean, whether or not we'll see a big announcement from a new innovative player looking to introduce a kind of a new small hybrid regional aircraft, I think that's going to be something to watch out for as well.
Thanks, Mike. So turning now from kind of traditional aerospace programs to more forward-looking technology areas, we're expecting a fair amount of buzz around the electric aircraft market or hybrid electric aircraft. Jay, I know you follow the space very closely. What do you think we should watch out for on this front in terms of, you know, are there going to be aircraft flying at the show? Are we going to see, you know, demos of urban air mobility vehicles? You know, what should we expect?
Thanks, Joe. Yeah, this is certainly starting to become a much more prominent topic in the industry. And while we are certainly still many years off until major commercial service for an electric or hybrid electric aircraft, much of the critical design and development work does need to begin today. And that is why you have started to really see some pretty notable public displays, development opportunities, and engineering advances from not only many legacy providers, legacy suppliers in the market, such as Collins Aerospace, Safran, and a whole host of their supporting suppliers, but even some new entrants in the market who are taking advantage of many new leaps in battery technology and power electronics and motor capabilities to really start to show the world what is possible with electric and hybrid electric aircraft designs. There are massive operational cost savings that can be afforded, certainly lower emissions or completely eliminated emissions, which is going to be essential for the industry to meet many of its lofty emissions goals into the future. So this is going to come, and it's just now a question of how quickly these technologies evolve. It'll be interesting at this show to see how prominent this discussion is amongst these large tier one providers. It's a key pillar for some of them, like Safran and Collins. And then we'll also probably have an opportunity to see some displays from new companies, whether that be Eviation's new Alice demonstrator, which is going to be powered by either a Magni X motor or a Siemens motor, as well as perhaps other new players like Volt Aero and its Cassio aircraft. We also expect Airbus to probably bring out one or two of its new demonstrator programs, either the Vahana or City Airbus, both of which have had some successful recent test flights in their respective development locations. So it is certainly something to watch this show and see how committed the various suppliers are to starting to embrace this change.
Great, thanks. Yeah, and I think I've seen something as well about Boeing and the passenger air vehicle that they've been developing with since they acquired Aurora. So it sounds like you're expecting both technologies in terms of, you know, more electric aircraft or electric capabilities in traditional commercial aircraft, as well as potentially vehicles that are solely electric powered.
Correct. I think we are not in a place where we can see major air transport happening off of a hybrid or fully electric architecture, at least in the next 5 to 10 years. But as we look further into the future, that will happen. And the best way for that development timeline to be accelerated is for the industry to start introducing bits and pieces of those architectures in today's aircraft. So, of course, the Boeing 787 is a great example of bringing more electric architectures into the aircraft. And certainly should Boeing launch a NMA aircraft, that might see another opportunity for more electric architectures that can help us continue to prove that technologies will be ready for hybrid and full electric propulsion in another decade or two.
Makes sense. Great. Thank you. So changing gears a little bit and going back to Chris, perhaps, I think one of the other trends we've seen on the industry side has been, you know, we've had these, as we talked about previously, we've had these kind of mega mergers or consolidation in the industry. The other thing that you're seeing quite frequently is moves towards vertical integration or insourcing, very publicly at Boeing in a number of instances, but also with a number of different firms. And I know it's something that we're tracking very closely. Chris, can you talk a little bit more about the trend you're seeing towards vertical integration in the market?
Yeah, you know, I think Boeing's going to use the air show to highlight some of its initiatives to control more of its supply chain. So you can think about things that it did recently and in cabins with Adient APUs, it's a joint venture with Safran. So I think you're going to see some of that at the air show from Boeing and from other airframers talking about either vertical integration, their supply chain, or getting more into the services market, which is almost a form of vertical integration as well, because that's been typically the purview of their suppliers. So I think that's going to be back in the spotlight, and this is a real shift in the industry that's really underway after a lot of outsourcing from the airframe OEMs back in the early 2000s. I think what's driving a lot of that is the production rate goals that they have. Those are really aggressive, particularly on the narrow bodies. A lot of the emerging technologies also allowing them to bring more back in-house, so things like additive manufacturing, automation, digitization. Those are all encouraging, I think, the airframe OEMs, particularly Boeing, but others, to rethink their place in the supply chain and how they work with their supply base.
Yeah, I think that what's also interesting is that Boeing is certainly making a lot of aggressive moves to show this insourcing trend, and it's not to say that Airbus is not. We've seen press coverage that indicates they are having a lot of serious looks at many of their both current entities in the aerostructure side as well as some other areas where they could integrate, but it does appear that the vast majority of their attention lately has been a bit more on the digital services and design work to help ensure that future product planning does have more clear integration from a data perspective, monitoring the way systems are both engineered, produced, and then ideally can be sustained in the aftermarket, to Chris's earlier point about a lot of this all leaning with a view towards how do we capture more aftermarket opportunity. So I do think that will be an interesting follow-on effect, is seeing how Airbus really focuses on some of these internal initiatives and then eventually perhaps pivots back to a vertical integration strategy down the road.
Yeah, and you know, the other thing to mention here too is the one area of similarity between Boeing and Airbus on the vertical integration front is around seating. And so the interiors part of the business, which is heavily impactful from an aftermarket perspective, you change out seats much more regularly than you change out oxygen and avionics and ejector seats on the defense side, whatever it is. The aftermarket for seating in the commercial market is very active. And so the interesting thing you see in the parallel between Boeing and Airbus is the trend toward SFE seating, where you're not going to have to make your selection through a BE Aerospace or through a Zodiac. You're going to be able to pick from the Boeing or Airbus catalog, ostensibly at a fairly significant savings. The benefit there, of course, from the OEM perspective is you get the aftermarket on those seats, whether that's refurbishment of the existing seats or it's the next generation of seats when they need to come out. So I think it's interesting that that's the one area of overlap that we see between the two OEMs in terms of vertical integration. And I think it has a pretty profound implication for UTC and for Safran, because Zodiac and BE are two of the strongest BFE seating suppliers. So something to think about as we go forward in the interiors market.
Yeah, thanks, Logan. I think that's going to be critical to track as well. So turning now from sort of the industry side more to, you know, kind of general market developments, and going back to Mike, I think it's been a perennial source of conversation and speculation, but the future of the middle of the market space and, you know, whether and when we're going to see new aircraft released is obviously something that people are continuing to track. What do you think we can expect at the show? You know, any big news events, any releases? What are you looking out for?
So I'll certainly be looking out for Airbus bigging up its XLR. Personally, I'm a bit on the fence as to whether or not Boeing will be really talking about its NMA aircraft. I think with the hit that they've taken earlier this year with the MAX, I think that's where their focus needs to be in rebuilding their credibility. And I think the question that then leads me to have is, if they don't bring something up on NMA this year, is it going to be too late? You know, they're saying that they can still hit a 2025 timeframe for the middle of the market aircraft. You know, releasing an aircraft or at least announcing an aircraft program in 2020 and then going from, well, effectively your design phase all the way through to production in 5 years is a pretty ambitious task, even for Boeing. So I'm a bit torn as to what we can expect.
Okay, so turning to defense, you know, the defense market is obviously a major part of the show, although I think in many years it winds up taking a bit of a backseat role versus the orders competition between Boeing and Airbus. Personally, I'm going to be looking with pretty keen interest at the combat airspace, both whether to see whether we get any announcements about the outcome of, you know, ongoing competitions, particularly in the fighter market, but also really tracking what's going to be happening on combat air and future combat air in particular. You know, BAE really stole the show at Farnborough last year when they kind of had this surprise unveiling of the Tempest concept and the sort of, you know, full-scale mock-up of a notional aircraft. I think the expectation, or certainly if you talk to folks in France and Germany and elsewhere, you know, the hope is that they can respond in kind, you know, with something that's strong and compelling for the Franco-German FCAS program. But I think it certainly remains to be seen whether that really comes to fruition or not, you know, and whether it's just more of a progress update or something more forward-leaning in terms of, you know, funding levels or work share or actual concepts or architectures associated with it. I'm curious, turning to Matt Karas, who really, you know, specializes in this market for Avascent. What's your bet? You know, do you think we're going to see very much, you know, whether from the Franco-German efforts or other FCAS efforts globally?
Yeah, you know, I think that, I mean, look, I think it's a good bet that you're going to get some sort of announcement just because of the dramatics of the show, right? And so, you know, the Franco-German effort unveiling some sort of concept, you know, regardless of if it ends up looking like whatever the actual solution eventually is, you know, 15 years down the road or not, will look good and will be nice and dramatic for the show. I think the more significant one that I'd be looking for announcement would be something on the industrial side, and particularly, frankly, going back to Tempest, you know, because they've been looking at other countries as possible development partners, given all the politics of Brexit and the competing Franco-German effort. You know, you could see a sort of non-traditional alignment with Britain and another country, you know, Japan and India, something like that, to find the funding and the industrial base and everything else, the political support to get this done. And I think, frankly, that would be a more significant announcement as far as the actual trajectory of the program than, you know, a concept, but a concept would look cool and would certainly, you know, grab some of the attention and headlines. And I think that's probably something that, you know, the FCAS program specifically could probably benefit from at this point.
Although if I was a betting man, I would say that given the limited British presence at the show, or I think we'll be more likely to see something come from the Europeans or maybe even, you know, some sort of forward-looking marketing from the U.S. front on the export side.
Yeah, for sure. I think or from one of the other countries that's talked about, you know, either fifth or beyond generation efforts. I mean, you've got Korea and Turkey and India and others who've all identified things that they want to go forward and pursue. And this is an interesting time to potentially make those announcements.
Yeah, yeah. I think we also, you know, so historically, in terms of, you know, near-term developments, you have an eye on what's the new aircraft at the show. I mean, I remember there being a ton of buzz around, you know, F-35 and its introduction at Farnborough a couple of years ago. I think it's a bit of a lull this year in terms of new platforms coming to market. One of the few new aircraft that's kind of coming online is the TX, which is the Boeing trainer, Boeing and Saab trainer that's being provided for the U.S. Air Force. Do you think we can expect to see anything, you know, regarding that aircraft, or do you think, you know, anything regarding the trainer market more broadly?
Yeah, you know, what I'd be looking for with TX is, you know, whether it's in, wrapped up in some sort of reveal or not. I mean, obviously the aircraft's been seen and is in early stage testing and everything else, but it would be some sort of announcement or even just a perspective from Boeing and Saab on how they're viewing the wider market for this aircraft. And by wider, I don't even just mean training. You know, if you look at the numbers they talked about, Boeing explicitly talked about as the business case for the aircraft, it's far beyond, not even, I would argue, just U.S. Air Force trainer requirements, but likely Western addressable training requirements. So you're really talking about some other capacity, light attack, light fighter, something like that as an envisioned role for the aircraft. And so how aggressively, you know, they start to market that, do we see a concept for a ATX or an FTX or something like that, where you start marketing it for those roles and sort of down market for major fighter aircraft kind of in a number of different places across the globe could be something that I would expect to see, whether at Paris or at some point in the near future.
Yeah, that makes sense. Okay, thanks everyone. Well, looking forward to seeing you all at the show, and thanks everyone for listening. This has been Avascent on the Record. If you liked what you heard or you had questions or specific ideas coming out of the podcast, please feel free to reach out at europe@avascent.com.
You've been listening to Avasant on the Record. To learn more about Avasant, go to avasant.com or follow us on Twitter @avasant.